Guten Morgen.
Good morning.
How are you? Happy Mother's Day.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day to
You
you too.
mother. How's it going?
It's going all right.
Did Harley give Barb?
No, Harley hasn't even seen Barb this morning yet.
Why? Is Barb out and about?
She's still in bed.
Oh, good for her.
She went to
Morning.
she, good morning. She went to bed probably about 2 hours ago.
I don't know how she does that.
Yeah, that's. I haven't been able to stay up late like that in a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
She
can't
went to.
imagine how much stuff I would get done if I could stay up like that.
I know. Like, just
Y
one of those
yes,
people that could
yesterday I
just,
like
sleep.
ate a late like supper. Well, no, it's like a it was like a linner. It was like a late went to Olive Garden and got that like buy one get one or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
And so I ate the meal and the soup, and I was like, man, I was like tired after that, so I took a nap. And then I think I got back up and I read a whole bunch more of Jonah Hex because I've been on a Jonah Hex kick. And then I started watching I watched Birds of Prey again and then passed out after
Wow.
it ended.
You were tired, I guess.
Yeah.
Finding myself taking naps a lot, just I think because there's like not much to.
Because you can.
Yeah. It's like there's only so many, like so much I want to just watch or read all the time. And then after a while, it's just like, just feel like taking a nap.
Yeah.
Are you working full time
Me?
still? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
But
okay.
he's been taking some days off, like Mondays and
Yeah,
other
I did
times.
twice. I took a Friday, Monday off. Last time was a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Are you accruing a lot of vacation because of this?
Well, when you what do you mean when you say
Well, how
that?
much vacation do you have? Like
Yeah. So
I have like 300 hours.
oh, okay. Yeah, like we you gain a certain amount, and they did. Previously, you could have up to 150% of whatever your total could be, and then, but that includes like from last year or whatever. They did raise it because of this to like 175, but I mean, I still need to take days, otherwise, eventually, I'll end up towards the end of the year,
Yeah,
I'd
it's
start
like
losing
a
time.
use or lose kind of thing,
Yeah,
right?
yeah. Some people can just keep banking them forever, and in other businesses or other, whatever. But yeah, not with mine. You end up losing them,
Yeah, same
which is
here. You lose them, but you could always roll your vacation up to 400 hours.
Oh God. Yeah, ours isn't. How much is 4 hours? Is it 10 weeks?
A long time. Yeah.
Yeah, we can't do that much. Yeah, like I said, I mean, the most you can do is like. So if you get the most you can have is 6 weeks of vacation for a current year. Like if you have 25 years of service, you'll have 6 weeks of vacation. So the most I guess you have any one time is 9 weeks,
Yeah.
but it could never get higher than that. And as soon as it would start
But I
accruing
thought it
more,
was 150 of what you could get. So then
yeah,
it would be more than that, right? So
it would be the
if you could get
six
9 weeks, then you can
more.
get more than 9 weeks.
No, I'm saying the 6 weeks at 150%. That's why the total would be nine. So that's the most you could have. But I get 5 weeks vacation.
Yeah. You
Yeah, we
get
can't.
more than me.
Really?
I get four, but I've been rolling them every year, so they accumulate.
That's good.
But I get an op no, I get more than that when you think about it, 'cause I get the 4 weeks plus five sick leave. I mean five days sick leave, so that if you roll them all together, it's the same.
Oh, that's good.
and some optional holidays. Like
yeah, we
five,
get
five,
yeah,
five, 5 days of optional holidays and then your fixed holidays.
Oh, okay. We have mandated holidays, and then we have like short notice days. We've got 7 short notice days, which basically, I mean, for a manager, in, at least in my department, doesn't really make a difference that you can use one or the other. Nobody really gives you a hard time. If you want to call that morning and say, I just need to take a vacation day for such and such, they're not going to say we have to use a short notice. They're basically one and the same.
How about you, Chris?
We can't really save anything. We have to use everything in the same
year.
Calendar year. I mean, technically you're accruing that amount throughout the year, but you know, you, as long as your balance comes out, comes out even at the end of the year, you're good, you know, but you can't carry anything over.
Wow.
I thought that they might change that.
Some of them were lifting it because of the COVID, because they know you can't go on vacation.
Right.
At least temporarily, like for this year. But there's still a lot of companies that didn't.
Yeah, we haven't heard anything that they're going to make any changes to that. So, yeah, I mean, I've started to schedule a few days here and there. You know, I mean, even if we had the option of going on vacation this year, I don't think that, you know, I think it would be limited what we'd even want to do ourselves anyway. So,
yeah.
I just want to visit my folks. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only vacation I need to do this year.
So what else is going on?
Just wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, in our county, it doesn't seem like we're going to be opening anytime soon in our county. I don't know how much you follow it, but
no, I don't think so. Which I'd rather. I mean, I'm glad to not be living in one of these states that are like opening back up with numbers that are still climbing. So at least
well, they can be the test scenarios.
Yeah, I guess.
Because, yeah, it's crazy. It's like as it's climbing. Oh, well, you know what? I think it's time to open it back up.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some guy I was following on Twitter. It was really interesting. He said he didn't post up until for a while because he had COVID, and he posted his symptoms. And I found it fascinating because for him, he never had the shortness of breath, which is usually one of the prime ones, but he got tested. He did have it, and he had the fever. The fever, like, was lasting weeks, though. Like, wow. He couldn't break that fever for a couple weeks. So he had that fever, and then he was lethargic and just weak, and he couldn't even focus on anything, like turn on the TV and watch a program or anything. And then he had that tasting thing.
Like, oh, he did.
He said he couldn't taste anything. He didn't want to eat anything. Everything was just bland and awful. And then the only thing he could keep down was like apple slices, he said.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was interesting to see that because it affects so many people differently.
That's what I was going to say. It's so weird how it's just so different person to person. And they constantly, I mean, I guess it makes sense that you learn more and more about it because it is new, but that like every other week you find out something else that could be an indication, or like, you know, like the last week with all these kids, I don't know if you guys heard about that, but like a lot of kids are getting these strange, rare symptoms that are similar to other like very rare diseases that they're testing positive for COVID.
And I hear there's some relationships to pregnancies too, or something, but I didn't really read into it. But yeah, it's not a good time for anybody. That's for sure. I just got off the phone with my mom.
How is mom doing?
Mom's doing good, but she's really depressed for her sister, who, you know, just lost my cousin. She's a mess. I mean, it's not a good time for that family, and it's affecting my mom a lot. So.
Oh. Yeah, that's gotta be.
And my mom and dad want to be here, and they can't, so it's wearing it thin, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have that interpersonal connection.
Yeah.
You know, phone calls and even FaceTime and stuff only does so much.
But she told me something really that just pissed me off. Like, I just got me so angry that my Aunt Lourdes, who's in California, and she was at, like, a grocery store, more like a Target, but, you know, like one of those joint places. And there were two teenagers in back of her, and she asked them, she had her mask on. They didn't, obviously. She asked them, can you, please be 6 foot dead? There's a line marker there. Can you please be behind that line? And they went up to her face, and they coughed and spit on her. And I'm like, God,
are you kidding
damn.
Me?
God.
I've seen this stuff in the news, but, I haven't heard anyone that
I would have broadcast loud and yelled I'm just so angry like right now. I just like I wish there was the guesser, my comic character, and he'd just like predict this shit. And I just hate people sometimes. I just can't stand them.
What is wrong with people? I really don't get it.
Yeah, and then it's just like if you go listen to your governor speak, and then there's all these assholes, Oh, masks don't work. Yeah, listen to Joe Bob instead of science, The fucking CDC is telling you, and you won't listen to the CD, but this guy who says, it's not working, why would you listen to that jackass? You won't listen to a doctor. I just can't believe I believe that this is my opinion. I believe our current president has made our world dumber. I really do. And I believe that. I believe that he's made the United States dumber.
It's kind of like Idiocracy.
It is so much like that.
I really think of nothing else. It's made it acceptable to just broadcast your stupidity with, like, impunity. You know what I mean? It's like before, some people maybe would keep their stupid ideas to themselves. That doesn't happen.
I mean, I do feel for the businesses that are closed. Like I really do see their points of view. Like I'm fortunate. We're all fortunate enough to be working through this. There are a lot of people that can't, and it's killing them. Like they haven't even gotten their checks in the mail, those stimulus checks, or they haven't gotten their loan
because
it's still waiting in paperwork and they can't feed their family. So it's like, you got to see all sides of this, and it's just, don't make an outbreak worse than it has to be, protect yourself. I just don't know why people don't want to.
And
just go back in science. Like, I was reading fucking Jonah Hex, okay? Jonah Hex, he looks at a sign and he's like, don't enter the town because there's pox, you know? And you know what the first thing he did is he puts on his mask. He puts on a mask to go in. I mean,
really?
He did? Yeah.
He let people dictate and deny him his civil liberties?
He put on a mask. Jonah Hex did.
Wow. Look at that. See? Jonah Hex can do it, then so can you.
That series is incredible. Holy mackerel, it's so good.
Oh, yeah. Very good. But
I don't know. He could be like one of the best Western characters just ever created, just period. There's not a lot of dimensions. Like, there's not a lot of dimensions to Frank Castle.
No.
But there's these little nuggets. I mean, there's these little nuggets. Like, he had a wife, and then he's got that relationship with Tallulah, and he's got that Native American background where he was raised by them. It's just like an incredible like journey that this guy it does, and he's a bounty hunter, and he's just I just dig him. I like Jonah Hex, man. I really do. But why don't we get started?
I got a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Now I know you, Mike, Chris. Do you have DC Universe or do you not?
Yeah.
Did you guys see that they're doing like a rewards program now?
I heard because somebody was complaining about them losing points or something. I don't know what they're Aaron.
Oh, they're
Aaron
losing
from
points.
Nerdy. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know you could gain points.
Yeah.
For watching so movies.
they just started it, like I want to say, Wednesday, but I was just watching a couple short programs. Like sometimes I'll watch that DC Daily if it's like an interview with a creator or something like that. And so I look and yeah, I mean first just to sign up, you do have to register in there. So Mike, make sure you register, and Chris too. You just go on the app and there's a reward section there where you register and then you get a bunch of points just for that. Like, I don't know, 70 points or something like that. But then when I was watching these shows, it was giving me 10 points. I started reading Young All-Stars. It was giving me 15 points for every comic book I read. And, I think it said something like, I'm not 100% sure, so don't quote me on this, but I want to say it was like, 250 max a week or whatever. But then you look at the rewards, and they have like Harley Quinn animated from the DC Universe show, little statue. It's like 1,500 points. So like after like 6 weeks, you would have enough for, and that's the most expensive thing on there. You'd have enough for that. They have like T-shirts for 600 points. It seems like,
and you really get them, and they ship it to you or what?
They'll ship. Yeah, from what I understand, you redeem your points and then they'll ship it to you.
Well, I'll have to sign up for that for sure.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my god! And like again, I'm not sure if that point max is correct, but like I was at, I don't know if it goes, you know, let's say it goes from Sunday through Saturday. Well, it only came into existence on Wednesday, and I was just reading, you know, the Young All-Stars and stuff like that, plus the you know, joining the club, I got points. I ended the week at like 230 points just from like 4 days. Oh my god. This is awesome.
Well, I do use it quite a bit. Like,
well,
yesterday I watched,
you're gonna do anyhow, so it's like it's not like you're going out of your way.
Yeah, yesterday I watched 2 episodes of Harley Quinn. That's so raw. It's so
I've seen about
so
6 of those.
It is so bad, but even Barb was like sewing in the other room, and she said, "Is that Jason Alexander from Seinfeld?" And I'm, "Yeah, that sure
is."
Oh,
yeah.
And then
Zach
Wanda Sykes is in there. I just got done watching the Queen of Fables or whatever she was. It was Wanda Sykes playing her. It's hilarious.
Oh, okay. Oh, but yeah. So something to definitely look into, guys, because it's just free stuff.
Yeah, I looked yesterday just to see if Hex was Jonah Hex, the movie, was playing, because I had the sealed Hex comic, the one that has the movie poster.
Uh-huh.
And I read it and I was like, you know, I should rewatch that movie. I know it wasn't like totally traditional, but it did get into like the Jonah Hex that was in the Vertigo series, which I liked a lot because it was like Truman and I can't remember. Yeah. That was supernatural twist to Jonah Hex, but I did dig it. Like I've always liked Hex. Like whether he's in that futuristic Road Warrior or he's in Gotham, I just dig him. He's just so good.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I just love Tallulah too, man. You put Tallulah there, I adore her. I wish comics could exist for me. Like, I wish I owned DC and I could just say, hey, you're going to do a Sergeant Rock. He's like, yeah, I don't care if we're losing money. I don't care. I'm just gonna do it.
We're losing thousands on this book. Oh, that's too bad. We're still going to make it.
That's all right. We'll get him in a movie. Don't worry about it. He would make such a good TV show, because if you use the Palmiotti Gray formula, it's like done in one series that kind of like you could just have one episode and then go to the next.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it would be so good.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so I guess we can get started.
Chris
huh?
Chris has a time limit. So,
oh, yeah.
Let's let Chris tell us about what his journey was this week.
So I watched an older movie last night, or we watched... Sunset Boulevard. It's from 1950.
Wow.
I've wanted to see it for quite a while, because it's pretty historically significant, pretty well known as an important movie. You know, it was one of the it's usually on like greatest movies lists and stuff like that. One of the first films that was put in the Library of Congress. It was directed by Billy Wilder. It was kind of one of the first films that was sort of showed a darker side of Hollywood. It's about a screenwriter played by William Holden. And he's struggling to make a living. Like, he's had some success in the past, and but he's having trouble getting his getting work. And he's got some creditors that are trying to repossess his car, and he's dodging them, and he's out on the he's out in his car, and he's at a stoplight, and they spot him from the other side of the intersection. So he takes off, and in the process of trying to get away from them, he gets a flat tire, so he pulls into the nearest driveway, and it ends up being this huge extravagant mansion, and he's mistaken. At first he thinks it's abandoned. It's like this old Hollywood mansion nobody lives in anymore, because the pool is not being taken care of, and it just it looks run down. But then a woman calls to him from the window, and he is mistaken for somebody else. So he's beckoned to the house by her servant, an older gentleman, and brought into the house to meet this woman named Norma Desmond, who is, it turns out, a aging former silent film star. So he gets increasingly drawn into her world, where she's kind of, she's got this crazy script that she's working on, and she wants to hire him to clean it up for her. And she's convinced that she's going to be able to make a comeback. It was interesting because, you know, 1950, it's now 70 years ago. But already at this point in time, Hollywood had a history of several decades, you know. And silent film stars by 1950 already were, you know, a lot of them had had difficulty making the transition to sound. And Norma Desmond is played by Gloria Swanson, who herself was one of the biggest, most successful silent film actresses. And she had sort of a similar trajectory to the Norma Desmond character, except after she had difficulty making the transition to talkies, as they were called, she did end up having she ended up moving to New York and having some success in theater and television and stuff, whereas the character just kind of kept to herself in her mansion in this sort of demented fantasy world that she creates for herself. She's inside her mansion, you know, she still has lots of money. Inside of her mansion, she's surrounded with pictures of herself. And since the actress actually was a real silent film star, that they're, you know, actual pictures of her from like 30 years ago or so at that point. She has a painting that goes up and reveals movie screen behind it, and they watch one night one of her movies, and for that they used one of the actress's actual a clip from one of the actress's actual movies. So it had a lot of interesting parallels to real life. There's people that make cameos in the film. There's a scene where she has some friends over to play bridge, and William Holden's character refers to them kind of derogatorily as her like waxworks. One of the people she plays bridge with is Buster Keaton. And the other two are also formerly stars.
It's an actor playing Buster Keaton, or is it really Buster
Keaton? No, it's really, yeah, these are it's really Buster Keaton, because they're not identified.
Wow, that's kind of impressive.
Yeah, they're not identified as by name, but they're just making cameos. It's really Buster Keaton and really these two other lesser, I mean, their names are H.B. Warner and Anna Q. Nelson, which they were well-known names for silent films. It's just unlike Buster Keaton, their names haven't like continued to be recognized to the same extent today as his is. But likewise, like the famous director Cecil B. DeMille is in the film playing himself. He has a more extensive role because he's the director that she wants to reconnect with and wants to do her comeback with. And you know, there's a scene where they go to the Paramount lot, and she's mistaken because she had sent her script in, and she's mistaken that they've been trying to get a hold of her because they want to bring her back and do her movie, but when in fact they just want to borrow her old car that she still has for a movie, you know, and William Holden's character and her butler find this out and try to keep the secret from her. And it turns out that her butler is actually her, used to be a director and, was her first husband. And he so wanted to be back in her life that he accepted a position as her butler, even though she's been since married twice. So it's about also like the screenwriter character and his struggle to like whether or not he's going to accept this sort of, he realizes that she has a romantic interest in him, and whether he's going to accept this sort of relationship or whether he's going to reject it. And it gets complicated by this young woman that he meets that's in her 20s, that she's just like a editor of scripts for Paramount, but she's interested in writing as well, and she takes a look at one of his old scripts and finds something interesting in it. They start secretly working on a script together at night, and it creates a romantic complication. But yeah, it was kind of neat, the parallels to real life, because like I said, Cecil B. DeMille plays himself, and he actually was the director that gave the actress who plays Norma Desmond her start, and the actor who plays her butler, Eric von Stroheim, he also was a director of the silent era.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah, he had a lot of clashes with Hollywood bosses and stuff over budgets and things like that, and was banned for life as a director, and ended up just going into acting to stay in the business. But he also directed Gloria Swanson back in her silent film days. So combined with the cameos and stuff like that, it had a real connection to the actual history of Hollywood. It's just interesting to think, like 70 years on from when the film was made, how it's interesting that we think of 1950 as a long time ago, but it's interesting to think of the fact that at this point there were already people who had worked in Hollywood that found themselves on the outside of they weren't interested in working for, like, so it led to me, like, there's a number of different, like, silent film actresses. There were some parallels, like I said, with the actress who played Norma Desmond, but also with other silent film actresses. Like, as I was reading up on it, they talked about like Mary Pickford, Clara Bow, and other names that were more familiar to me than others, but and the fate that they each had. Like, a couple of them really struggled with mental illness or alcoholism and stuff like that later in their years, and some of them did apparently live in old mansions like these, with, like, surrounded by pictures of themselves. So there's a real, like, it's kind of like a film noir, and there's definitely like a sadness about it that was kind of interesting. You know, there are some aspects, because it's 70 years old, there are some aspects, like, particularly I found, like, the score to be kind of like a little dated, you know, like the swells of, like, emotive swells of, like, when something happens, like, kind of melodramatic, you know.
Yeah.
Felt a little dated, but the themes were interesting. It's interesting, like, how much hasn't changed, you know. Like, it's not revealed until, like, later in the film that the actress is only 50 years old.
Everyone seemed older then.
Yeah, I mean, and she does seem a little older to our eyes now. Like,
yeah.
But it was interestingly, like, at the time that it was made, because the actress was only around 50, and William Holden was in his 30s, and they really kind of wanted to, contrary to what would normally be done, they wanted for the themes of the film to emphasize their difference in age. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about making her look older, and she didn't want to do that, and pointed out that someone with the character's amount of money would have the resources to look younger. So they actually worked on making William Holden look younger. But the whole theme of, like, actresses as they get older, struggling to find roles and stuff is something that hasn't changed enough. And
I was just going to say that. That's you know, with a few exceptions, that's kind of been the case. Although I would say the past few, maybe 20 years, like a lot of big name actresses or the big name actresses from like the late 80s and, I mean, not all of them, but like Julia Roberts and stuff like that. Like, she could still get movies made for sure. But it's still very, very relevant. You know, there's no doubt about that.
It's relevant to everything.
Yeah.
It's relevant to any industry. Comics industry, you'll see the passing of the guard. You'll see people that were such big names when I was a kid that can't get a job writing comics if they wanted to.
But you know what?
Unless they produce it themselves. I mean, it's, you see it with people just working in the industry. I mean,
well, yeah, but particularly with film, you would traditionally see male actors age into different roles and female actors age out of business, basically, unless they wanted to play a bit part as a grandma or something like that.
Yeah. Unless they're an actress of a certain caliber,
they have, like Meryl Streep,
like Helen Mirren, or any of those that have been around long enough that have such a name that they can act in anything.
I feel like it has been a little bit better, you know, recently in the past few years with a lot of those, you know, like the Helen Mirren or so forth, but. I think as a society, we don't think of whether it's in your 30s to 40s or even 50s as that old anymore. Whereas like years ago, that was old, you know? You know, what's funny is that we've been watching, I've been actually showing the kids Leave It to Beaver.
Oh, that's such a great show. I love it.
Oh, my God. They get such a kick out of it because he's literally the same age as they are right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And but anyhow, Ward Cleaver, he doesn't – I can't relate to him.
He's such a stern man. He's such a stern, like
– Even today, I look at him.
Personality-wise, like, he just comes home.
He's
an
old guy. He's the exact same age when the first season came out that I am right now.
Yeah.
And like, he just seems old, like, or I guess it's, I am old too, but I don't feel like I present myself in the same way. And of course that's cultural and you know, how things were in the '50s versus now. But
well, back then it was a traditional nuclear family. Like you had the mom, the dad and the kids, and it was a little more wholesome. At least they made you think it was.
Yeah. And even like you lived. And present yourself like you're not going to see him be goofy and wearing a t-shirt and shorts. you know what I mean? Just like,
yeah, he just he was a dry father though. I thought like I think what is the mother's name?
June.
Yeah, I think she had a lot of personality and stuff. Huh. And Ward was just stern. Like he was just He went, did his job, came home, sat with his pipe, and then read the paper.
Uh-huh.
And then told some lessons, maybe. I don't know.
That's right.
And Wally and Beaver were good kids. I mean, Eddie Haskell is the little devil on the shoulder. Like, he's the friend that you all have that wants to push you in to do something.
We just watched.
I had friends like Eddie Haskell.
Eddie in it last night.
Yeah, I love Leave It to Beaver. It's good.
So, but go ahead.
No, it was interesting to see more things change the more that they stay the same, I guess. You know, I mean, there are definitely big differences. You're talking 70 years, but not as much as you might think, you know. And
just like the Spanish flu, and now we're dealing with the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Same thing. The more they change, the more they stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I unexpected. Like I said, I was reading up on some of the lives of the different silent film actors and actresses. That actually, without thinking about it, I was putting myself into that generation that dealt with the Spanish flu, because you know, a lot of them were born like around the turn of the century.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, 20 somethings when the silent films were being made, so they were born around 1900, and yeah, there's like a sequence. You know, in some ways, like, things haven't changed. Just the technology has gotten better. Like, life expectancy has gotten better. But, like, you think about, like, we're all well aware that, like, of, like, Botox and things that these, the Hollywood celebrities are, so when they're 50, they're trying to look like they're 30.
Yeah.
It's just, they were doing the same thing back then. It's just the technology is better, so they're more successful nowadays. You know, mm-hmm. they can actually get close to actually accomplishing that goal.
Yeah. Like,
there's this whole sequence when Norma's convinced that she is going to be making her comeback. There's this whole sequence of, it's almost like a training montage from the 80s, but it's showing her all these, doing all these weird, having all these weird beauty experts in and doing all these, she's walking around, she has like little things on her face and she's got her like chin strapped by this thing to try to, doing all this stuff that they don't do anymore because they have better ways of doing it, but the what they're trying to accomplish is the same thing. So it's like the technology has changed, but the goals haven't, you know. And
yeah. But technology, too, leads to the whole condition you're talking about. Like, the silent to the talkie and people yeah. losing their jobs. Well, it has technology, too. As technology changes, people lose their jobs because the technology changes.
yeah.
And those that don't adapt to the new way usually lose their jobs.
Yeah.
And it could have to do with, like, film, comics, like colorists, the way coloring used to be done versus the way it's done now, mm-hmm. lettering, all kinds of different things.
Yeah. Yeah, and tangentially, like I said, I ended up reading about a bunch of different stuff after watching it, and I was reading about Buster Keaton, if you ever get a chance, it's interesting just to read up on like the stuff that he did, like in his like heyday when he was really like at his most popular and making his own movies and stuff, like doing basically what he wanted to, whatever he felt like doing. The way things that have changed, talking about things that have changed, is like the rules of like using stunt doubles and stuff like that. Nowadays, like, even the stars that want to do their own stunts, you know, like the studios are not inclined to let them because of the investment that they have in them, you know.
But
he kind of preceded that, and it's just, if you look into like some of the things that he did and the like risks that he took, it's just kind of crazy. Like, he broke his neck and didn't realize it until years later.
My God.
One time, you know, when on an x-ray, a doctor like looked at his neck and on his spine and could tell from like the way that his spine looked that he had broken his neck. When like a stunt went wrong and he was hit by like the force of a ton of water. But his most famous stunt is, When you've probably seen like clips of it, when he's standing in place and the whole front of a two-story building falls over on top of him,
and then the window,
and he goes right through the window.
Yeah, that's pretty famous one.
That stunt could have killed him if he was like a few inches off of the spot that he was supposed to stand, because that was a real that.
Heavy.
It actually weighed 2 tons.
Jesus. Wow.
What they were dropping on him. So if he had like been off his mark, which was just marked on the ground with like a nail, he would have just been killed. And you think of like, no one would even take that. If anyone took that risk, you know, they would have to, it'd be something that they did on their own, you know.
Right.
wouldn't be allowed by the studio, but
yeah, I'd be one of those people from MTV kind of doing it. Johnny Knoxville.
Apparently, like
it's like a Johnny Knoxville.
Yeah, I didn't really think of that connection myself, but apparently, like Johnny Knoxville named Buster Keaton as like a huge inspiration for him.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I've never seen that movie. Of course, you know, I've heard of it, and you know, I know that it's one of those, you know, hugely influential movies, and it sounds pretty interesting, and the fact that it's still relevant 70 years later, it's impressive.
Yeah, I've just seen like, you know, montage of clips from his films. I haven't like sat down and watched one, but you know, they're like the Marx Brothers movies where they're like, it's a movie, but you know, it's like 45 minutes because
yeah,
they were limited in their reel.
It's really that short? I didn't realize it was that short.
I think some of them are, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Or like a lot of the Marx Brothers films and stuff are like an hour at most, you know.
Yeah. Interesting.
As opposed to what we think of as a movie now, but.
That's cool.
Yeah, something a little bit different, but yeah, I found it interesting. And it's neat. It's one of the things that's cool to have seen because it gets referenced a lot in culturally significant kind of thing.
Yeah. Mike, do you want to go next? Or do you want me to?
I can go. That's
okay.
This one I didn't even know existed. I knew the character existed, but I didn't know this comic existed. It's called Heroes Incorporated Presents Canon. It's the first appearance.
I've got this comic.
Yeah, it's the first appearance of Canon. Did you read it?
A long, long time ago when I picked it. Like my local comic shop just had it just there, and I thought it was very odd.
It's from the magic year of 1969. Wally Wood, Steve Ditko.
I do not have issue two.
I do have issue two with a certificate. Okay. It came from Bob Layton's personal collection.
Oh.
So Bob Layton was the editor on number two, which is interesting enough because number two was done in like 1976. So it's like number two continues the story, but it's many years later. It's in black and white, and it's magazine style. The size of it, you need a magazine bag and board.
Uh-huh.
It's not in color like this one. If you Google this one, it's listed as one of the first independent comics, whether that's true or not, or what you consider independent. It's 15 cents cover price. It was sort of dedicated to the armed forces. As a matter of fact, at the back they have salute to a Medal of Honor winner, Corporal Robert E. O'Malley, Marine Corps. So it's a very interesting book. The one thing that I've learned is I haven't been like I knew of Wally Wood because of the Thunder Agents, which is probably his. It's either E.C. Hoare or the Thunder Agents you know him from. And I have some Thunder Agents, but not all the Thunder Agents. And I heard about this canon because IDW had a collected edition of it coming out. But I didn't even know this was his first appearance. And this book was sent to me by Dennis Chandler of the Best of the Rest podcast. And I'm really thankful to get it because I immediately went and bought number two once I found out about it. And number two has like a pinup of Dynamo, which is a Thunder Agent, in it. And this features three stories. One is Canon, which is my favorite. Dragonella, which is more of a humoristic story, and The Misfits. And Canon is... In a nutshell, he's sort of like a Captain America, except if they made the perfect soldier and took away all his pain receptors and personality and just made him more of a robot. That's what Canon is about. So in the first issue, a beautiful woman, he draws women, so God almighty. I just, Wally Wood is pretty doggone amazing. Actually, the art on this, he's inked by Wood, but it's Ditko. And so Ditko's doing the art on it, which is very unique because later on, from what I understand, Cannon goes to Eros because it becomes an adult comic.
Oh.
So it's like rated X, but I don't think it's like rated triple X. It's not like reading like a cherry Pop-Tart like I've been reading, but it has material that has sexual situations and stuff like that. So in this story, a woman is captured because she knows like the secret behind nuclear weapons. So the United States can't have that. So they get Cannon to go after her, and his orders, they tell him you could just kill her because she's not worth, she has secrets in her. Go ahead and just kill her because we can't let that secret out. And he's pretty much a robot. He goes there with a bunch of fighter planes. They get rockets launched out of him. He crashes into the water, but he's the only survivor. And then he gets there and gets where she is and sort of rescues her and is going to kill her, but he finds out that she already revealed the secret. So these guys already have the secret to the nuclear weapons. So he's like, well, why should I kill you now? I'm going to save your life. He gives her the rocket pack and he straps his rocket pack on her back and launches her into the sky. And this plane just has this hook that can pick her up out of the sky and drags her along. And they said, oh, it's not Cannon. He should have killed you. And, he didn't kill her. And then when he gets back, after he destroys all of their arsenal, all their planes that could possibly launch the nuclear weapon, they know they have the secret. So the United States comes and drops a missile on that whole island to blow it up. But Cannon luckily gets away in an escape craft. And the girl comes and says, oh, I can't believe you saved my life. I love you. And he's just like this robot. He goes, must make my report, and goes on, straight-faced and all. The other thing is this is during Vietnam. Visit the USO from your home, and it says buy U.S. savings bonds. So, like, you'd see these in the old Superman comics and Batman comics, buy savings bonds. But now in the Vietnam War, you also see that. The Misfits is a sci-fi adventure about three telepathic beings. One is a mutant that's super strong. One is an alien from another planet. And one is an android woman, kind of like the Vision, and they can all, like, speak telepathically. And there's this alien that's pure white. They call him the White Man, that's going to destroy the world. And the Misfits are put together to stop that White Man from destroying the world. And they have that telepathic connection, so they can talk without speaking. They invade the secret warehouse, stop the White Man and the plans, and actually kills him. The little alien guy actually takes like a pipe to his head and destroys him. And you think, well, that's all said and done. They saved the Earth. Everything's okay. But the story's continued in issue two, because that was just one of the aliens. There's a whole bunch more. They just stopped one guy from destroying the world. And I guess this wasn't like a popular book, because there's an open letter from the editor that says, this is your book, you know, write in, write to Armed Forces P.O. Box in California. Sincerely, Wally Wood. And there'll be more issues coming your way. Well, there wasn't more issues coming your way. I don't think. I think maybe Bob Layton really liked this comic book a lot and maybe brought it back in 1976. I don't know what the story is or why it's there, but I don't think it had anything to do. The publisher even changed. It wasn't Armed Forces anymore and didn't do whatever this comic was because it was designed to, I think, make money for the military. It's an interesting book. But then there's Dragonella, and she's basically a baby that was born in this kingdom. And the queen says, you got to get rid of this baby because I don't want her to come back and be, you know, the queen. So get rid of her. The jester looking dude just takes her off into the forest and leaves her underneath a tree where a baby dragon finds her. And then she's raised by dragons. and it's really, this is drawn by Wally Wood, and it's a really cool tale. She's supposed to kiss a prince, and she never kisses a prince. She kisses another creature thinking it's the prince, but it's not. It's just another creature. So it's one of those weird irony things where you think it's going to go one way and it doesn't go that way. And she ends up hanging out with her dragon baby friend or whatever he is. But it looks like he's got the hots for her. And it's kind of like her brother, because they were raised together, but they're not obviously brother and sister. So that's the tales of the Heroes, Inc.
Very interesting. Did you see the price on our
tracker? Yeah, I don't think that's right.
No, that's not right. I went on eBay.
Yeah. It's really high for number two.
Yeah, so it's $225, but that's not right.
It might have been at one time. What I hear the story is, I don't know if it's on number one or number two. Somebody tweeted at me that the book was really rare, and then somebody found a whole warehouse full of the comics.
Oh, geez.
So,
okay.
I don't know.
Was it Bob Lake?
I didn't know if at one point it was a rare book, and then they found a whole bunch of them, so supply and demand kind of thing. But
yeah, because I went on eBay and the first thing that came up was a number two unread, very fine direct from Bob Layton.
Yeah, that's where I got it. What was the price on that one? What was the I bought it right there.
$25.
Yeah, if you want it, this is what I did. You can try to go lower. You know how it says best offer.
Yeah.
I just put in 20 and it was accepted.
Oh, cool.
I thought it was fair to go $5 under, and I did, and I didn't expect it to get accepted. I just tried it and it worked.
That's interesting. All right, that's cool. That's good to know.
I think I like number two better.
Oh, really?
Because I don't know if it's the black and white or whatever, but the art is just like, oh my God. And then it's got like all these pinups. It's just amazing. It's an amazing book. It looks incredible.
Oh,
and there's like a Val Merrick that draws, and he's pretty incredible too. He draws another story that wasn't in this one. If you like art, this is a great book. And I think the story between like the Misfits and the Cannon, or they're very interesting stories. Like in the second one, Cannon's fighting Nazis. So
the number two has, so besides Wally Wood, it's saying John Byrne and Howard Chaykin too.
I did not see them credited, but I didn't look hard enough. Maybe I will right now when I talk to the next book to see if they're in there.
Huh. Wonder. Yeah, I don't know. That's awesome though. You guys did some interesting things today.
Well, you've been on a tear, man. You've been reading a lot of great things.
The first thing that I'm just going to mention today, I'm not really necessarily going to cover one particular story, but I just want to talk a little about DP7 because I just finished reading 32 issues in the annual of that one. And
can I tell you that book, I kind of got mad. I was listening to a podcast, 11 o'clock comics, And Jason Wood was talking about how this book doesn't hold up. And I just read it like 5 years ago, and I thought it was
doesn't hold up.
I thought it was amazing.
How do they say it doesn't hold up?
Well, for one thing, I hate that term. I despise it, doesn't hold up term. Because it's not supposed to. You're supposed to, like, you're not supposed to read it and compare it to the times now. You're not. I just don't get it.
I'd like to know what that means. Like, when he says that, what does that mean to him?
To be fair, maybe he meant it doesn't hold up to him. In other words, the way he worded it is he said, like, back in the day when he was very young, the new universe came out. And he absolutely adored it. Like, it was the best thing. It was like getting on the Valiant floor, right? Like, you have to get every issue of everything, you know? Star Brand, Night Mask, DP7, Kickers, Inc., everything, you know? Just, and he loved it as a kid. And then it was like going back home, going back and reading it, and it just not having the same memories as it did when you were a kid.
And that's sort of a legitimate thing.
You kind of said the same thing with Outlaw Nation last week. So
yeah, I can get that.
For me, I never have that feeling. I don't know how I read comics differently than most people, but I tend to like everything I read better the second time, regardless of year.
Well, I mean, this book, 33 issues altogether, including the annual. The entire thing, except for the annual, where I think they had a guest artist, but the 32 issues had were all written by Mark Grenwald, and Paul Ryan was the artist for every single issue.
And he's incredible. He's one of the better artists that came out of that new universe, I thought.
And since they couldn't get Paul Ryan for the annual, they got some dude named Lee Weeks draw that one.
Well, some dude.
So it definitely, I think, maybe in comparison to some of the other ones, I think it definitely benefited in a single team the entire way. Like, I look at some of those other books, and I mean, towards the end, they might have had a different writer every single issue until ended. Not the case with DP7, and it's definitely, you know, I mean, it definitely is set in the late 80s, you know, 86, 87 through 89. And in terms of what you would expect for your style of comic book back then, you know, I mean, each issue has taken me, you know, took me a good 20 minutes or so to get through. You know, there's lots of dialogue, there's lots of description. I was thinking about this as I'm reading this, and especially being that it was a so-called team book, although when I talked about it on Twitter, whenever I read one of them, I was careful not to call them a team, because they're not a team at all. This isn't, they're not a team, they're not a superheroes. They're just a group of people that, you know, got to know each other. But anyhow, I was thinking in my head, if this book would come out now or in the past 5 years, or even probably longer than that, maybe past 15 years, I don't know how they would do it, because you know how much everything is decompressed nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, There were seven characters in here, plus all these other ancillary characters, you know, whether it was family members of the characters, situations that were going on. At the beginning, they were at a clinic, so all of the staff and everything at the clinic, the other paranormals at the clinic. There's no way they would be. I mean, a single issue would have been a story arc nowadays. So I really, really enjoyed the fact that Grenwald was able to really get a lot of story in every one of these issues. And like I was saying, I mean, it was very refreshing to read. And also I went in, already was kind of
thinking.
Did
you read these digital or did you read them in print?
Read them in print.
When you, I need to ask this because I didn't know about it. I knew a lot of people did not like Shooter, and I knew New Universe was a mandate. Kind of, we're gonna do this like editorial driven type universe, and I know John Byrne didn't like it, and I saw that you read The Pit, and it was, from what I understand, it was John Byrne's middle finger to Jim Shooter, and I wanted to know if Jim Shooter was still around during the time The Pit was written,
no,
or if he was gone, right?
Yeah, he was gone. Who is the next one? That was Howard Mackey, I want to say. Or maybe he was just a regular editor. I don't remember who the editor in chief was at that point.
Fascinating that some. I understand why creators didn't like Shooter. I personally really like him. Like I think he understands like why people come back for continuity. In the expense at the expense of the creative team. Like, but I like it as a reader. So like when he's involved and he's like, he's kind of in everybody's guiding the boat or whatever, the plane. I kind of like that he's doing it because it makes you want to come back. It's the type of storytelling that makes you want to come back. And it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation where an editor can take control and then take away from the creative process. But I tend to, anything that Shooter's involved with, I find it very excellent. Like I just enjoy him.
Well, that's actually where I was kind of going with this too, Mike, is that as far as I'm concerned, I've said it before, after I've read this whole series, I'll say it again, this was, at least to start out with, it was the prototype for the Valiant universe under Shooter.
Yeah.
This, the first 12 issues of this series, I mean, think about it. This is a group of people who suddenly get strange powers. They all come together and come to an organization that is ostensibly there to help them learn and control their powers. However, the leader of the organization has nefarious plans that are not apparent to everyone there. And as they start learning about them, they quickly decide to leave the clinic. They go on the run. They're being chased. They finally do get captured. Back all but one of them, the big guy, his name's Dave, his code name, if you will, would be Mastodon. They rarely used code names. The teenage kid made them up for everyone, but most of the time he was the only one that used them. So they come back, Mastodon comes in and manages to rescue everyone, and they actually then defeat guy that's in charge of the clinic that has crazy paranormal powers, and then they start for a short time start running the clinic on their own before they kind of go off and do other things and eventually go to New York City. So I mean, I feel like there's a lot of parallels obviously between this team and Harbinger. There was just so much storytelling for each one of these characters. You really got to enjoy the stories. And I found it to be really interesting that it didn't even occur to me until later. I was reading some Wikipedia stuff that one of those incarnations of Supreme Power, the Squadron Supreme.
Yeah.
I don't remember which one it was. But one of them has a person. Each person on the team is from a different Marvel universe in the multiverse, and the fast guy is not Whizzer anymore. It's Blur from the new universe. It's the black guy who's super fast.
Oh, was that?
And I totally forgot that.
That happened when Straczynski was writing it, right?
Is that what it was? I couldn't remember which one it was.
I think it was Supreme Power. Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of Squadron Supreme, it was Supreme Power.
Right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so too. But I mean, I read that. Yeah, you're right, Mike. It is. I read Supreme Power when that came out, but by that time, it had been almost 20 years since I had read, or at least 15 years since I read DP7. I totally had forgotten anything about it. Then when I went back, I'm like, oh my God, they actually used Blur. That's amazing. And then Alan, I don't know if you guys saw, but Alan had tweeted me back that these characters in DP7, they appear again in a Quasar, big arc, 12-issue arc. It actually includes a 4-issue miniseries called Star Blast, and then it's got a bunch of issues from Quasar, a couple from Fantastic Four, and a couple from Namor.
That's interesting, because I just found a couple issues of Star Blast in a dollar bin.
I've never heard of it before in my life.
Yeah, I haven't either. I was like, what is this? What is this? I don't know about it. I'm going to buy it. I did not know the link on the new universe, though.
Yeah, so Alan told me, he just said it continued, those characters continued a little bit in a few issues of Quasar, and then showed me the issue of, I think it was 54. So I started investigating. It's a whole 12-issue story. So I went on my comic shop and bought all the Star Blast and then the Quasar issues that I was missing. I have the Fantastic Four and the Namor already. So, I also bought, I don't know if you remember, you talked about the Pit. They also had then later called the Draft.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know who attacked Pittsburgh, so they instituted a draft to get paranormals in the military. Well, the last part was after all of the regular series ended. They came out with another thicker book called The War, and that started up right, I think, that same month that the three series that were still around their last issues appeared. So I bought issue 1, 2, and 3. Much to my surprise, in the database when I was looking, there's an issue 4. The reason why I don't have it is it came out about 6 months after issue 3.
What title?
4.
No, I know issue 4 of what title?
Issue 4 of The War.
The War. So, yeah I want to complete this universe, and I didn't realize
so 1, 2, 3 came out June, July, the August. War. Then nothing came out until the following February. At that point, I mean, I was just getting stuff at the comic book shop. Yeah. It's very possible either he didn't bother ordering any of them or had one or two, because, I mean, it's a 6-month delay in the last issue of a miniseries of a dead universe.
Yeah.
I had it existed, so I picked that up from my comic shop too. So when I get those, I'll read The War, and then I'll get myself into that Quasar arc.
Yeah, I so much want to make a My Comic Shop, but my cart in there was getting so big that I'm going through right now and putting stuff on, what do you call it? It's not on your cart, but save for later. Yeah. Because my mood changes so much. And right now, you got me in the mood for finishing this universe, because the new universe, I'm only well read in one character, and that's Nightmask. It was the only one that I was picking up at the time. And then I got DP7. I can't remember if Knutson sent me the first 10 or something like that. And then I just went and completed it, and I was like, this is my favorite, but I hadn't read any of the others. And then I read what's the other guy? Starbrand?
Starbrand.
Uh-huh. And that's, I was like, holy crap, this is like Green Lantern. It's like the same, it's like the new universe is Green Lantern. Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to go back and read some of this stuff. And like I said, I mean, it definitely benefited from that team of Grunwald and Ryan just there the entire time. And the fact that Grunwald was writing Quasar at the time too.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite.
Decided to bring him back.
He's one of my favorite writers of all time.
Me too.
Because him and Tom DeFalco they had this thing of making you, at least when I was young, making me want to come back. Like, I just love their storytelling technique because it was, they don't make comics like that anymore. They make it like one story instead of like five threads.
Yeah.
And the way that
What I really miss.
Oh God. Yeah. I used to love the five threads because each one was in a different part. And as one ends, a new one started. And it always made you... It made a comic what a comic should be. Like a serialized form of entertainment that you want to come back for. Instead of a story. Or like, I just need to read six issues and then I'll get the full story of this one story. Right. I miss that. And that's... You say Grenwald? He's a master at that.
Is,
I wonder
yeah.
how he felt about Shooter. I wonder if he liked him because I heard that he went to the. I don't know how true this is because I didn't read the Marvel Untold story. I've always wanted to, but I hear that stuff's in there, like the party that burned through when Shooter was fired and then did the pit. I hear he's like a hardcore editor though, like. You're wrong, and I'm right.
Even if he had his problems with him, in particularly, he must have enjoyed writing this book because I mean they stuck with it that entire time.
Yeah, I love to go to. Have you been to a Shooter panel, like
yes.
at a convention? Oh God, I love him in a panel. I've been to like three of them, and I don't know. He's amazing. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think that's where the difference comes down to is like him as an, like experiencing him as an editor, as a reader, and him as an editor, as your boss.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You don't want him necessarily as your boss.
But I think he knew what he was talking about because we're talking mm-hmm. about a kid that was hired when he was a teenager. And they didn't even know he was a teenager to do Legion of Superheroes. They said, this is amazing. Like this
right.
person knows how to plot. Let's send him out on a plane. Oh, can you get my mom to approve the plane? Because
like your mom,
what your mom, what are you talking about? You're a kid. You're writing this story and you're a kid. Like I think he got it really early on, like what drew him. And he tried to like have that formula. And we might have hated him as a boss, but I think the product that comes out for the reader is a good, like he was a true editor. And some editors, they'll let the creative team like just do whatever they want. And this guy was a guiding force. Like he was a true editor. And I like what he was involved with.
Yep.
I just wish he was, I wish he had success with something that he never had to sell. Like a board didn't have to push him out, or I just wish he had control over his own universe, like Defiant, and it was successful. Like some of his universes that came afterwards, they were fantastic, but that was when the industry was going down the toilet already.
Yeah.
So there's no way it could have succeeded.
No, and you know, I mean, and that's the thing, and it's true with anything, I'm sure, but, you know, with, like, Shooter being the way he was, you needed to have a very strong and very talented talent as well. People that had the strength to fight for what they thought was the best way to do stuff and be able to butt heads and come out of there with the best, you know, with the best version
right.
of that sort.
And I think it's a collaboration. Like when you get really good, it has to be both ways. Because if
right.
the creative team hates it so much, it's going to come across.
It's not going to be successful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you're being told
anyhow,
what to do, then you're truly...
I just wanted to talk generally about the book just because I loved it. I loved it more than I expected to. I remember liking it. And again, I probably only read the first... 10 to 12 or 13 issues. The rest was kind of me.
You are so into my mode right now because you're reading like I read. This that's like I have to read. I have to like like I just did on the Hex. I just plowed through that whole box that you told me to go through.
I know, that's
awesome. And it's like the best way to read, because it's like you see all this stuff, and it's just, I don't know, it's such a joy. Like, I'd love to read all my comics like that.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. I really want to do the new universe next.
It's fun.
I just love dead universes. I get a kick.
And there's not a lot to this one, so, you know.
Yeah, I still have to finish Atlas, but those last few are being a bear to track down.
Well, that's the other benefit with new universes, that generally speaking, they're not expensive.
Yeah. But then you might, if you're not careful, you might miss things like the draft and the war and the pit. I mean, I did have the pit. I don't know why I ordered it. I probably ordered it because it was John Byrne. That's the only thing I could think of. Because I bought that when it came out. I bought that and Night Mask. Night Mask was like Dreamscape. That's what Night Mask was.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. He's heavily shown in the draft.
Yeah.
He's got a big one there.
And Hickman sort of brought them back in his Avengers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Chris.
All right, so I'll also talk about Superman number 9. Speaking of John Byrne.
Volume 2.
Yeah, volume 2. John Byrne and Carl Kessel. So yeah, this is an interesting sort of crossover of superhero and supervillain, because it deals with the Joker. It's called To Laugh and Die in Metropolis. And it starts out with Superman walking into a jewelry store. Is there some kind of trouble, Superman? Or they're trying to figure out why he's there, because there's this really special jewel on display there, and they've increased their security and stuff. So it's actually sort of the opposite of him showing up is making them a little nervous that maybe something is, he knows something, that something's wrong. But then he walks up to this diamond, and the telltale grin of Joker appears on his face. And his whole face sort of changes into that of the Joker. And this green cloud of smoke starts pouring out of his ears. Well, we know that must not be the actual Superman. And meanwhile, Clark Kent is talking with Lois in the at work. There's this package that on Clark's desk, and Lois is bugging him to open it. Because I guess it was delivered to him and he sort of forgot about it, and the whole staff it's gotten to the point the whole staff is curious as to what the heck is in this package that he hasn't bothered opening. And he opens it, and it's a scrapbook. And she grabs it from him, and it's this. There's all these clippings. She's like, "Well, it's just a bunch of clippings from newspapers about averted catastrophes." You know, you can kind of see some of the headlines, like "Freak rainfall brings drought relief," something about airplane landing safely after a malfunction, blah, blah, blah. And then she says, "Oh, wait," but about halfway through the scrapbook, it turns into stories on Superman. So we can figure out who put this scrapbook together and why, it goes from these clippings about averted disasters and to Superman, but then he's like, well, I just remember something I have to do, and it's actually because he picks something up on his super hearing, and he takes off and he goes to the scene of this incident from the beginning of the story. Sorry, I had to clear my throat. And it turns out to be a robot. When its fist that's holding that diamond goes flying off, and inside of the robot is a nuclear bomb. So he lifts it into outer space, as he does with nuclear bombs. It's a convenient distraction for him not to go after the diamond. Meanwhile, in a farmhouse just outside Smallville, a woman is putting up wallpaper, and a little tiny flying metal device kind of looks like almost like a smaller version of Booster Gold Skeets comes flying in through the one window and zaps her in the eyes. So we pick back up with Superman in the Mojave Desert. He's just sort of recovering from dealing with taking a nuclear blast. And then back in Metropolis, Captain Sawyer, Maggie Sawyer, is dealing with the aftermath of the Superman robot attack. And, you know, you have your typical victims with their rictus grin smiles. Superman's recovered enough that he makes it back to Metropolis to talk to Sawyer. And, you know, at this point, it's pretty clear who's responsible for this. And if it's not some kind of copycat, Superman's trying to figure out why Joker is in Metropolis instead of Gotham City. But Superman picks up something on his hearing that only he can hear, and he flies up and try to find out what it is, and there's a balloon with a smiley face on it in the air, letting off this high-pitched signal. It's actually the alert from Jimmy Olsen's signal watch, but it's cranked up so high that it's almost deafening to him. And it's attached to that balloon, and it's got a note on it from the Joker that he's got Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, and Perry White sealed in lead-lined coffins in various spots around Metropolis. And so that leaves him with either the choice of, like, stopping the Joker from leaving the city or going after his friends. And so then we see that this is indeed true as we switch scenes, and that the Joker has those three captive. So they're not actually in the coffins, though. They're inside this, like, this fake oil tanker. Joker gets a call on this phone, and he gets some bad news, and he goes and runs to a window and finds out that his oil tanker is miles above the tallest skyscrapers in Metropolis. And, of course, Superman is beneath it, flying it out to Stryker Island. And he plunks it down and just allows himself to smash through the button, the floor. He explains that he wasn't fooled by the whole lead line coffin thing. Joker made a miscalculation because the way that his X-ray vision works, the lead line coffins around the city stood out because he couldn't see. Because he couldn't see.
They stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. So he was able to find them very quickly and at super speed discover that they were empty and track them down. So it's kind of like a short little story, and it doesn't switch to like a new title, although it does like change page number. The rest of the issue is taken up by this little kind of short story about Lex Luthor. You could tell he's like outside the city, some like small town, because there's a big actually kind of nice visual storytelling, like without using a caption or something. There's just a big sign in the foreground outside this diner that says Metropolis 900 miles. That puts you in your place. Lex Luthor is sitting in this diner, and you see some of the waitresses are gossiping about it. That he asked specifically for this waitress Jenny's table. They're like, her tip's gonna pay off her mortgage. And so Luther asks her to sit down. She's like, well, I can't do that. He's like, you can do what I ask you to do, because I probably own this restaurant. I own 90% of the state. And so then he basically like makes an indecent proposal before the movie ever came out. he invites her to come back to Metropolis with him for 1 month. It's kind of gross. He's like, if you doubted that he is actually means what he implies, she says, well, I happen to be married. I'm not that kind of girl. And he says, if I've learned nothing from my 8 wives, it's that everyone is that kind of girl. It's only a matter of price.
they stole that for the movie.
Yeah. And so he offers her like $1 million for 1 month of her life. And she gets mad and says, you know, you think you can come waltzing in here and just offer me money and buy me and blah, blah, blah. He kind of starts getting into her life. You did this and you danced in the school play, and you were a bright child, and your high school cheerleader, most popular in school, dated the football hero, married him. But then neither of you could afford any other education. So now you're 22. You got a husband, a house, and a mortgage. Probably have 3 or 4 children. You got a television set that can show you the world, and a highway sign to remind you of your dreams. $1 million can buy a lot of tomorrows. He says, think about it. I'm going to go to my car for exactly 10 minutes. Think about it. And then he leaves. And so the rest of the women that are working there were like, what the heck was that all about? Blah, blah, blah. And she tells them what he offered her. And they're like, you got to be kidding me. You're going to do it? She's like, are you serious? And one of the older waitresses says, man, if somebody offered that to me when I was your age, I would have taken it up in a second, basically. And she's like, I can't believe you. And she's like, what? To have the time of your life for a month and then come back and have enough money that you'd be set forever. And so she kind of hems and haws, and she goes back and gets on the payphone and calls a gas station and asks for her husband. And her husband answers, says hello, and she hangs up. And then she goes out and Luther's gone. And the last couple panels is just Luther's driving away, talking to his chauffeur, and she said, she says, you waited longer than usual that time, almost the whole 10 minutes. And Luther says that, basically says she needed a little extra because she had a stronger morality than others I've played this game with in the past. But the result is the same. She'll never know what her final choice would have been, and that question will torment her for the rest of her meaningless life.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, so it's... If you wonder what kind of... you know, we had a lot of little different interpretations of Lex Luthor over the years, but if you're wondering if he's... you know, he's basically just playing games with people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you know, just for his own amusement, basically. So, but yeah, so it was an interesting kind of issue. You know, I've been a fan of John Byrne's art since I saw it when I was younger, and you know, when he got in his later career, kind of lost the detail that it once had, but I always enjoy reading his work as an artist, you know, and his writing, it tends to be hit or miss for me, but you know, I found this was an entertaining issue. Like, the first part was pretty simple because it was just kind of like a what if, like, how would the Joker deal with Superman kind of thing, and it wasn't that complex a story, but so it was interesting how the issue is kind of split in that way. Like, you know, there was only so much you could kind of get out of the idea of the Joker, but it made room for this interesting little short story that definitely was showed an insight into Luther's character for sure.
Nice. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Cool deal.
There you are. You want to go next?
Yes, I'll go next. It is my turn, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to Jonah Hex. So DCBS/Lunar is still shipping books during this pandemic because DC went around Diamond and they're able to ship some stuff. And I was very surprised. I don't know if you were, Rob, but I thought they were just shipping comics. I didn't realize they were going to do collected editions.
I was surprised as well.
I was shocked. I'm like, oh crap, my Shazam Volume 2 and my Weird Western Tales with Jonah Hex is coming in. And I am proud to say that I own all of the Jonah Hex issues. I own Weird Western, All-Star Western, Jonah Hex, Volume 1, Volume 2. But I don't own all of the Weird Westerns or all the All-Star Westerns. Well, I may own all the Weird Westerns because Scalp Hunter was in there too. But this was a collected edition that came out, and I was shocked it came out because I'm like, these aren't going to sell. They're going to cancel it.
And I thought the same thing, especially with the environment today.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh my God, it came out. And this collection features his first appearance from All-Star Western 10 and 11, which are very expensive books, and Weird Western Tales 12 through 14 and 16 through 38. So I've been reading a lot of the Palmiotti Gray, specifically the last few issues, because Rob said, you should get in that closet. And I got in the closet and, I found a lot of gold in there of stuff I didn't inventory. And a lot of it was like the cool stuff, like the tail end of everything before the New 52 came out. So I started reading, like, Gail Simone's Wonder Woman, Jonah Hex, the tail end of JSA comics, when long after Jeff Johns had left. Or it's maybe it's JSA All-Stars. I think they had a second title come out of that. And so I've been doing that, but I can't talk about those books because that was, like, 9 years. So I said, I'm going to talk about Jonah Hex, but I can dig into All-Star Western number 10 and 11, his first appearance. And what's interesting about Jonah Hex is they don't start off with an origin story at all. They don't let you know why his face is jacked up. All they let you know is there's this badass guy that's a bounty hunter. And the story's by Jan Albino with Tony DeZanuga. And I really wanted to watch the film, the movie, because I wanted to see if they were credited. I was like, I went to the DC Universe app, and I was like, God, they got to have Jonah Hex. And one thing I have found is their movies are, like, rotating in and out. Like, they don't always have the same movies. Like, 1 month they might have Batman, and then it's not there again. And I could have sworn at one time they did have Jonah Hex. Well, it's not there anymore. So I don't know what their policy is. It's kind of like the way their comics started off. Their comics started off like, okay, you can read Titans, New Teen Titans 1 through 20 now. Oh, we're getting rid of it the next month. That's how the app started, as like a rotating set of titles, but now it's a building set of titles, and I wish the movies were like that. But Jonah Hex is he's dragging in two guys, two dead bodies from his horse into town, and he goes into the bank and says, hey, these are the guys you wanted the reward with. They're with the gang, Jim's Raiders. And he said that's $200. They pay him right off the bat, cash. And they're like, man, you're the best money we ever spent. You know, you promised these guys, you brought them in. And he says, but there's a lot more. You just caught two of the eight, or I don't know, it was more like six. Plus, you need to catch Jim. And he goes, yeah, I'm well aware of that. And he goes, you know, they're going to be waiting for you at the bar. And he says, man, those guys are the stupidest bastards I've ever heard of, because they're waiting for me in the bar, yet they saw me drag two of their friends into here, and they didn't shoot me off my horse. They should have shot me off the horse right away, taking me out. So he sneaks in one of the windows in the saloon. There's this sexy woman getting ready, and he say, be quiet. I'm just sneaking in. I'm not going to hurt you. And then he gets in there with his six shooters. He's got them both loaded. And those guys are, like, waiting, like, right by the door at the saloon. And he just kills them. He kills three of them right there. And one of them gets away. So now he's got five of the dead bodies. So that's $500 he's earned. And then he's going after the sixth dude that's running away. And he runs into a kid. And that boy is like, oh, he's very honorary boy, and he goes like, get out of the way, kid, you know, I'm trying to kill this guy. And he's like, you put your hand on me and my paw will whoop your raw ass, mister. And he says like, oh, who taught you how to behave, you know, now get out of here. Well, that boy comes into play later on. So he goes to get more cash, and he goes into the bank, and he's like, don't worry about paying me until I go get the other guy that got away. He says, then you could pay me the full amount and then also get the leader. And then he goes to get his horse, and the guy's beating his horse. And it's like Jonah Hex just punches the shit out of him. He's like, you don't lay a hand on my horse. And then these guys are looking at him, and they're like, one punch. It was like the Justice League. took him out with one punch, like when Batman punched Guy Gardner. He's like, one punch. And he grabs his horse and goes after Jim and the guy that got away. And the guy that got away is like, this guy's supernatural. He's a gunfighter. We're going to die if we stay here. And sure enough, he says, why don't you go get some water so we can make some coffee from the well? And he goes, I don't want to go out there. Hex could be hunting me down right now. And he goes, go out there. So he goes to get the water, and sure enough, Hex is waiting and shoots him dead. And then puts him on his horse because he's going to ride him in for the extra $600. And then this guy, scared shitless now because he knows he's it, he says, I know all the backwoods here. I have a chance of getting away. If I sneak out the window, grab my horse, I'm going to get away. And he tries to get away, but then ends up in a house, and Hex tracks him down. Well, it's the house of the boy and the little boy that he met earlier. And he finds out that the bad guy, Jim, had his mom at gunpoint. And he says, if you come any closer and don't de-host her, I'm going to kill this woman. And he's like, he feels like, I don't know, some kind of kinship with this boy. And he's like, okay, I'll let my hoster go. And what I don't understand is he dropped his hoster. This guy could have easily just shot him. Like, I would have shot Hex right there. Bam, right there. And he rides off thinking, oh, I could get away, instead of killing Hex when he could have killed Hex. And Hex grabs, he reaches to the back of his neck where his hair is. He grabs a knife and just throws it in the back of his head and kills him. So he kills this guy, and then he takes it all, and he says, where's your paw? I thought he was going to rescue you. And he's like, I don't have a paw. I lied to you. And he goes off, and he says, you got to come back. My mom's going to make some apple dumplings. And he goes, okay, I'll come back. He goes into town. So what these seven dudes were going to do is they were bullying themselves into the land, because what they wanted was to get rich off the railroad. Like many of the Westerns, the land became valuable when the railroad came in. And the city knew that they were stealing this land, and that's why they hired Hex. And Hex is like, he goes to get paid, and they're like, man, you did everything. They pay him every cent. They don't try to pull one over on him like a lot of people do in Hex stories, you know, when they want to, when it's time to pay. No, they pay right up. And he's saying, you know what? I've been looking for a place to live, just to hang up my hoster. And I would like, is there any property? And these guys were like, no, there's no property. We sold the last house. So there's no houses coming up. We don't have any houses for Lex's view. They like don't want him to live there. And he's like, okay. He knows what's going on. He's not stupid. Like, he knows what they're saying. It's not there's houses. If they wanted a house, they just didn't want him there because
he's. Well, hi, Mabes.
He's
sorry.
Oh, no problem. He rides off and goes back to the boy's house to get his apple dumplings, and gets a shot right through his hat, and it's the woman, and she's like, get out of here. He saved this woman's life, but she threatens his life, and then he just goes off on his horse, and the boy wants to go with him. And this place is called Paradise Corners, and he just leaves and punches the sign as he leaves, because he wanted to live there. But it was a really cool story. I liked it. And this guy's art is like, poof. He's very hyper detailed. And
who did the art?
What's his name? Tony Dezenuga.
Okay.
He's very cool. He actually, if I remember correctly, he actually drew a few issues of Palmiotti and Gray stuff. So, like, he came back because this book's pretty doggone old, but I think he came back to draw for their series. And he's really good. Like, he's hyper detailed. And that's another thing that's so good about the Palmiotti Gray one shots is they have these, like, rotating art teams that come in for one story. And there are some big names. I mean, there's some really good, really good stories.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I love this.
I'm excited. I haven't gotten my hardcover. It's coming next week because, you know, I'm biweekly.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to looking at that, though.
What collected editions did you get that you have coming? Just that one?
Just that one for last week. I'm not sure if anything's coming for this week.
Mm. You didn't get the Shazam one, huh?
Which Shazam one is that?
That's the 70s series.
Yeah, I guess I...
It was Shazam Volume 1. This was Volume 2, which I can't believe it even came out, that one, too. But
I know. It's awesome. I'm glad that they're actually releasing some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. I hope we get more.
Oh, for sure. I'll do mine real quick, and then we can call it a day. We have to visit our both of our parents distantly.
Yeah.
As well. So I know Chris got to go in a few minutes too, so I'll be quick. The next one I'm covering is the Young All-Stars number 7. So if you remember, I was reading All-Star Squadron. I finished that up. And towards the end of that run, actually probably a good 15 or more issues, Roy Thomas, who was the writer, kept referencing a Volume 2. And Mike, if you remember, when we talked at one time, I'm like, well, I wonder why Volume 2 never happened. You know, right up to the end, he's literally talking about Volume 2 coming. And so then it was the last issue, and he's like, okay, here it is. It's not going to be called All-Star Squadron, but All-Star is in the name of the title, and it's going to focus on some new young characters as well as, you know, all of the characters that you're familiar with, and it's the Young All-Stars. So this is what he was it eventually morphed to. I don't know if that was his first thought when he first started teasing it, but this is in actuality the second volume of All-Star Squadron. And it's again Roy Thomas. He's writing with his wife Dammy Thomas. And in number 7, Howard Bender is the artist, and Brian Murray did the cover. And Malcolm Jones III from Sandman fame, I believe, and Bob Downs did the ink. But basically what you've got here is the Young All-Stars are a group of teenagers, or they might even be 20. There's 5 new ones and 2 older characters that kind of the new ones become interim All-Star squadron members. And Sandy from the sidekick from Sandman, and Dynamite, who is a sidekick from TNT, they join as well because they're both teenagers as well. In the initial book, TNT and Dynamite are up against some bad guys, and TNT actually dies. So Dynamite, the teen sidekick, is the only one still alive. So the new characters are Iron Monroe, or Monroe, I should say. He's got like super strength, and he can leap, and he seems invulnerable. And
but he was the grandfather to the Manhunt, Kate Spencer's.
I was gonna say, yeah. He shows up then, in Day, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah,
you've got the Flying Fox, who is a native, actually a native Canadian, he comes down to the United States to help fight the Axis powers. Because they tried to mess with his family and his tribe up north. There is Neptune Perkins, who appeared in All-Star Squadron just very, very briefly. He was in and out, very intriguing at the time, and then never followed up on. You think of him as almost like a human dolphin. He needs salt water to stay alive, so he stays around oceans mostly. He has webbed feet and webbed hands. He's got enhanced strength. He cannot breathe underwater.
Wasn't he originally part of the Axis, though, in All-Star Squadron? I thought he was a bad guy.
Thinking of the woman that he's kind of sweet on, and that's Tsunami.
Oh, Tsunami, also, that's right.
Yeah,
okay.
Also appeared in All-Star Squadron.
Yeah.
As a bad guy, as a Japanese agent. She actually was born in the United States, but she went to school in Japan because she was just constantly felt outcast. And when she came back, she actually came back with a lot of Japanese militant feelings, I guess.
And after, towards the end of the run of All-Star Squadron, she kind of she saw how crappy both the Nazis were, and like, why is my country aligning itself with a country like Germany? And kind of changed her way. And number one of this new series, she kind of, you know, comes there and says, listen, this is what I want to do. And they accept her to become an interim member. We also have Fury, who is not the Fury from Infinity Inc., but a Golden Age Fury who actually is the niece of Johnny Quick. And she's from Greece. And she kind of has these Greek Furies kind of, I don't want to say they inhabit her body, but they kind of lend her their strength. And then, of course, there's Dynamite, like I had mentioned. So along with Sandy, that's the team. Issue number 7 is a real nice, just easygoing one issue, one and done, where the All-Star Squadron is playing baseball at Yankee Stadium against the young All-Stars. And in order to have the right number of members on the team, you also have Adam, and I don't remember who. Oh, Star-Spangled Kid also joined the young All-Stars so they could fill out their roster. And in this particular issue, the young All-Stars are losing, and it doesn't look like they have much of a chance to win the game, because when they finally get the last out, and they're the last at bat, the young All-Stars are, it's got some, the first two that are batting are ones that really have no superpowers at all. Sandy and Tsunami are the first two up to bat. And Tsunami, although she's acting like she knows about, she's not. The other one was pretending. Tsunami has never even seen a baseball game until right then. So she has no idea what she's doing. Of course, Sandy's just a regular teenager. So he manages to hit the ball right away, but Amazing Man is chewing gum, and his power is that he takes the properties of whatever he's touching. So he's chewing gum on purpose. So he stretches way up in the air, and he grabs the fly ball for an out. And Tsunami ends up just striking, getting struck out. Wildcat is pitching. So the next one up is Flying Fox, and him from a very remote area of Canada has also never seen or played baseball, but he manages. They tell him to get the feel for the ball, and you don't know quite what his powers are yet, except for that he can fly. But you can tell it's kind of like almost like a spiritual type mystical power. And so he starts, you can see his eyes start glowing as if he's like really like focused on this ball, and he cracks a ground ball right past Robot Man and manages to get to first base before he can get out. Now, in the meantime, it looks like the Tigress is up in the rafter, not the rafters, but it's not in the stands either. She's like up towards the backs, looking in on the game, and nobody knows why she's there, but she alludes that she's going to be making her move when the time is right. Suddenly Green Lantern just flies. He's been very distracted. He actually missed that fly ball, and went to try to get it, when Amazing Man stretched and grabbed it instead. And he just flies off. So they allude to Millennium, for him as he leaves. Our man's in the stands, so he jumps down and he joins the team to get the 9 players. And Fury, she's like, oh, I love baseball. Fury keeps talking about that, you know, she's from Greece and she's been following American baseball her whole life, and she hits it line drive and manages to get on base. And then it's Iron Monroe's time and turn, and he wails it that it literally starts smoking and gets set on fire and just flies off. Hawkman claims that he flew up and caught it, and there's nothing but a tiny cinder left. And they start arguing before they're reminded that this is just supposed to be for charity. They're raising, they're trying to get people could come watch it for free if they brought
old scrap metal for the war effort. And so they declared a tie game. And they take off, the squadron takes off, the young All-Stars kind of hang out, and they get called to the office, and they're looking for the All-Star squadron, but they'll take what they can get because apparently there's something going on down by the docks. There's a U-boat just off of Long Island, and it wants to, it's trying to torpedo some British ships. So they actually, there's the interlude with the Tigress again. She's leaving, and she gets into a fight with the police, and she manages to get away. And just as the two of the army officials at the stadium say, "Have you heard anything back about those youngsters? Did they manage to get the submarine?" "No, I haven't heard anything." And you hear Iron Monroe say, "Oh, did I hear something about us youngsters?" It's like, "Oh, and by the way, are we still looking for scrap iron?" And he's holding the entire submarine, you know, up above his head with a bunch of knocked out Nazis all, you know, on top of it. So I thought it was a really interesting story in that it was just an easygoing, nice tale that literally still, apart from the game itself, had no action at all, except for a quick little one-page thing of Tigress fighting three cops. But other than that, it doesn't have anything at all, but it still was really just enjoyable to read. Just a nice little one and done. I'll be reading this whole series to finish up my All-Star Squadron type reading.
Plus, you got some baseball before, you know, we can't get any baseball games now. So
exactly.
Yeah, you got some baseball.
This one's 31 issues in an annual, so it's roughly the same length that DP7 just was.
Yeah.
So hopefully by next week I'll finish this out. And then I'm not sure what I'll read after that.
So this one you're reading in print too?
This one, I only own the first 12 issues. Instead of going downstairs and pulling it out, I actually...
It's available then.
App? Reading it on the app, I miss out on like the letters pages and the little stuff. Cause you know how Tom is constantly like, always has like a little box in there that he talks about like stuff,
but it's not
the same experience.
Right. But. Right. But it is good that you can read it there. So just for people that are listening, if you got the app, you can read that there.
Entire collection, including the annuals in the app. And what's nice is they position the annual in the next up, exactly where it appeared in, you know, publication.
Yeah. And you probably can read Superman Volume 2, Number 9 on there too, I would imagine.
Sure.
I did.
And Sunset Boulevard is available on Amazon Prime. So if you want to check that out, if you're a member, you get it to watch it for free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just as a wrap up, people can go look at. And DP7 probably has the first few issues on the Marvel app. I know they do Star Brand. They have quite a bit. So I'd imagine DP7 would have something. So we got to wrap this up. Some people are going to go see their moms. And you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. This is Geek Brunch Retro with Rob at Rob Krieger, Chris at MythMakingETC. And me at Mike Myers Brunch. And on Facebook, you can find us at Geek Brunch Podcast. Click the like button, follow all the episode threads there. And if there's any mothers listening, you won't listen to this on Mother's Day, but happy Mother's Day.
Happy belated Mother's Day.
Yeah. All right, you guys have a good one.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys.
Have a good Sunday.
See you.
Have a great Sunday.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
I'll be right with you in a second. I want to see if this recorder stops on its own or if I have to stop it.